Chapter 51, Agra, Almora, Cairo. The New Delhi branch of the Mahabodhi Society was located at the Buddha Vihara, the Buddhist annex to the very much larger Lakshmi Narayan Temple, a grandiose structure which, though dedicated to the second member of the Hindu Trinity and his consort, also had room for a host of lesser divinities. Both places of worship had been built by a Hindu multimillionaire philanthropist, and the difference of size no doubt reflected the relative importance of the two faiths in the eyes of a good Hindu. The Buddha Vihara occupied a special place in my personal history. I had first seen it in 1944, shortly after my arrival in India, and its modest shrine was the first Buddhist temple I had been inside. Next door there was a no less modest bungalow, on the lawn in front of which yellow robes were spread out to dry on that first occasion, but the door was locked and there was no sign of any monk. In later years, when I was myself a monk, I had stayed there more than once and had got to know the resident bhikkhu, Venerable Aryapansa. It was he who now welcomed Terry and me on our arrival from the airport, and who, after giving us tea, arranged for us to be accommodated in the library. There was much to see in New Delhi, but though my friend and I visited several handicrafts emporia and made a few purchases, our principal concern during our first 2 days in the city was to arrange for the dispatch of our unaccompanied luggage and to make inquiries about buses to Almora and trains to Agra. Almora was where my friends Lama Govinda and Lee Gotami lived, while Agra was the city of Shah Jahan and the Taj Mahal. Owing to the possibility of strikes, there was no certainty about buses to Almora. We therefore decided to go to Agra first and accordingly caught the fast Delhi-Agra tourist train early the following morning. I had visited Agra and seen the Taj Mahal once before in the course of my 1956 Buddha Jayanti pilgrimage with Dada Rinpoche. On that occasion I had been afraid that the beauty of the famous monuments might be spoiled for me by all the photographs and paintings I had seen of it, not to mention the plastic models that were on sale everywhere. But in the event, my fears had proved groundless. This time, therefore, there was no question of my being disappointed. I looked forward to seeing the Taj Mahal again, as much as Terry did to seeing it for the first time. On reaching Agra Station, however, we did not go straight to the Taj Mahal. Instead, we decided to catch the coach to Fatehpur Sikri, 25 miles away, and afterwards to see the Agra Fort, keeping the Taj Mahal for the conclusion and culmination of the day's sightseeing. The guidebook described Fatehpur Sikri as a ghost city, but it was a ghost city only in the sense that it had no inhabitants. There were many buildings of red sandstone, which in the brilliant sunlight, beneath a sky of cloudless blue, gave it a far from ghostly look. The city had been built by the Emperor Akbar, the greatest of the Mughal rulers of India, in the latter half of the 16th century. Originally it was to have been joint capital with Agra, but the water supply soon dried up, the inhabitants left, and for more than 400 years Fatehpur Sikri had lain deserted. Starting from the Shari Darwaza, or Martyr's Gate, Terry and I spent a couple of hours wandering from courtyard to spacious courtyard and from palace to palace, admiring the red sandstone pillars and arches and the white marble lattices, all intricately carved. Eventually we came to the Gate of Victory and the great Jama Masjid, or Friday Mosque, within which was the white marble tomb of Sheikh Salim Chisti, the Sufi saint who had predicted the birth of Akbar's three sons. Much of the Agra fort was out of bounds to the public, the place being a military headquarters of some kind, but we were nonetheless able to see the greater part of Shah Jahan's palace, with its halls of public and private audience, its baths, its little marble gem mosque, built for the ladies of the Zenana, and the pavilions that clustered round the high terrace overlooking the river Jamna. We also saw the famous tower from the top of which Shah Jahan, shortly before his death, had taken his last look at the monument he had erected for his beloved wife, and where he himself was to be laid to rest. After seeing the fort, we visited the beautiful tomb of Mirza Ghiyath Beg, and from there we made our way to the Taj Mahal. The entrance to the gardens in which the monument was situated lay through a massive arched gateway of red sandstone. Once inside, Terry and I saw a long avenue of dark cypresses, down the centre of which ran a waterway. At the far end of the avenue, flanked by its minarets, the world-famous building showed dazzlingly white against the blue sky. From where we were standing, it looked quite small, but from previous experience, I knew this to be no more than the effective distance, and indeed, as we walked towards the platform on which it stood, the rectangular frontage and surmounting dome rose ever bigger and grander before us. After climbing the steps leading to the platform and entering the deeply recessed archway in the front of the monument, we found ourselves in the high octagonal chamber containing the richly decorated cenotaphs of Shah Jahan and Mumtaz Mahal. The empty tombs lay side by side in the centre of the chamber, surrounded by a delicately carved marble screen. The actual tombs, simple and unadorned, were in the crypt immediately below, a smaller, much darker place which we also visited. On regaining the platform and the bright afternoon sunshine, we walked round the outside of the building, admiring the fine relief carving, then descended into the Mughal-style gardens where, as we wandered about, Terry took a number of photographs. Later, when they were developed and printed, we agreed that no photograph could possibly do justice to Shah Jahan's masterpiece. The beauty of the Taj Mahal, like the beauty of Helen of Troy in Homer, could not be described, but only inferred from the effect it had on the beholder. 2 days after our visit to Agra, we left for Almora, in the meantime having bought property and basketware and the cheese Lama Govinda wanted. We travelled the whole way by bus. The journey up into the Kumaon foothills took exactly 12 hours, with one change, and it was not until 8 o'clock that night that we arrived in Almora. With a coolie carrying our bags, we started climbing the hill behind the town to Haimavati, the bungalow where the Govindas had made arrangements for us to stay. We reached it at 10 o'clock, having passed the place in the dark and been obliged to retrace our steps. In the morning, after the caretaker had given us breakfast and I had inspected the contents of the bookshelves, we made our way up the rough track to the Kasa Devi Ashram, 3 miles away. The isolated stone cottage was situated at the end of a ridge and commanded a fine view of the snow peaks of the western Himalayas. My two friends had lived at the ashram for the last 10 years or more, and I had visited them there on 2 separate occasions. On our arrival, they welcomed us and the cheese with open arms, and I soon perceived that Lama Govinda's kindly, unassuming manner and Lee Gotami's more expressive friendliness had made Terry feel quite at home with them. We spent 5 days in Almora, not including the days of our arrival and departure. On the third day, we went down into the town for a few hours, principally in order to check the departure time of the Delhi bus and to visit the post office. The remaining 4 days were all spent at the Kasha Devi Ashram with Lama and Lee, as the couple were affectionately known to their friends. Each morning, we arrived at the cottage at about 11 o'clock, having breakfasted at Hamavati and read for a while, and stayed until the late afternoon or evening. As yesterday, spent the day in discussion with refreshments in between, reads one entry in my diary. Another entry reads, Lee showed her photographs. This took more than 2 hours. discussed my future literary work and other matters. Lee's photographs were those she had taken in the course of the Zaparang expedition, the eventful journey she and Lama had made in 1948 to 1949 to the ruined temples of Zaparang, the former capital of Western Tibet, a journey vividly described in Lama's book The Way of the White Clouds, then recently published. The discussion of my literary work was probably concerned more with the future than with the past. Lama had more than once strongly advised me to spend less time giving lectures and more writing books, and on this occasion he no doubt repeated the advice. Littera scripta manet. The written word remains. As for the other matters discussed, I must have included my difficulties with the English Sangha Trust and my plans for a new Buddhist movement in England, and I must have received a sympathetic hearing. On the last day that we spent with them, our kind hosts performed for us the puja of the Arya Maitreya Mandala, the Vajrayana order Lama had founded some years earlier, which had members in West Germany and Hungary, and I think the United States. Besides making the customary offerings, they chanted the refuges and precepts and recited Pali devotional verses with which I was already familiar. Thus, Terry and I left them with the words of the sacred texts and their own warm good wishes ringing in our ears. Our last days in Delhi and India were spent visiting the National Museum, where there was little of Buddhist interest to be seen, and the Ladakhi Vihara, which was quite dirty, as well as in writing a large number of letters. Among the dozen or so written by me, there were letters to the Kazi and Kazini, and to Lobsang and Thubten, informing them of the arrangements I had made regarding the future of the Triyanavardhana Vihara. On Sunday the 19th of February, shortly after 9 o'clock in the evening, we left for Cairo. In Cairo we stayed with Appa Saheb Pant, who was now India's ambassador to Egypt. Since I was feverish and Terry more depressed than he had been for a long time, we did not do much sightseeing. However, we did visit the Egyptian Museum, where we saw the gold mummy mask and other treasures from the tomb of Tutankhamun. And we did drive to Giza in order to see the pyramids and the Sphinx. I'd imagined these latter to be situated out in the desert, miles from anywhere, but Giza was now part of Cairo, and as we drove through the suburb, the Great Pyramid rose from behind the houses at the end of the street. Apart from a meal at the home of the minister to the embassy, these were our only outings. While Terry closeted himself in our room, I passed the time either talking with Appa Saheb and his wife Nalini, or reading about the civilization of ancient Egypt, or simply sitting in the garden. On Wednesday the 22nd of February at 7:30 in the evening, I gave a lecture at the Nile Hall. With Appa Saheb in the chair, I spoke on characteristics of Indian spiritual thought. The audience was not a large one, as President Nasser happened to be making an important speech that evening at exactly the same time. By midday on Friday the 24th of February, Terry and I were back in London.